taking their place in a long true line of everyday Americans,
helping to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. This is the Constitution Study on the America Out Loud Network with your host, Paul Engel.
Pay the bills, stay out of jail, love the neighbors and have a few good friends. Every day you were everyday Americans.
Hello there, everyday Americans, and welcome to the Constitution Study, where we read and study the Constitution. We teach the rising generation to be free. I'm glad you could join me today. Well, it's not exactly news, but by now you've probably heard that Associate Justice Stephen Breyer is retiring from the Supreme Court. And there's a lot that can go on around that. Plenty of people have been talking about, why now? Why is it that the White House announced the retirement before Mr. Breyer did? There's a lot going on there. But we need to understand a couple things. And let's start off with what I believe are the logic. What's the logic behind Breyer's retirement now? Breyer, I believe, is in his early 80s. He's certainly been around long enough. And let's face it, President Biden's approval ratings are really in the dumper. There's a lot of question about whether or not the Democrats will maintain control of the Senate after the midterm elections in 2022. So there's a political, the political odor here is strong. Is it proof that this is a purely political move? No, it's not proof, but, if it walks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, it's probably a duck. So what we have here is a standard political move, right? You have a justice that, let's face it, at 80 plus years of age, he's either going to be retiring soon or he's going to die soon. And if President Biden wants to be able to not only nominate but appoint a justice with his, let's say, judicial temperament, then he's got to do it now, because it doesn't look good for him to have his party to have control of the Senate after the midterms elections later this year. So there's a logical reason why this happens. But while we're at it, there's also been some, misinformation about the actual process and the understanding of the choosing, the appointing of a justice of the Supreme Court, right? Any federal court, but specifically here we're talking about the Supreme Court. Now, most people I hear talk about, the president nominates, the Senate confirms. Not exactly. Now, we can find out how this works by starting in Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution, which says, "And he, being the president, shall nominate, and, by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, shall appoint ambassadors, other public ministers and counsels, judges of the Supreme Court, and all other officers of the United States whose appointments are not herein otherwise provided for, and which shall be established by law." So notice this. This is the way it's supposed to work. The president nominates. That's true. That's understood. We're okay with that. There are not rules about who the president nominates, how he chooses his nomination. The one assumption is that he's going to nominate somebody who's qualified for the office, but there's more on that later. So the president nominates. Now, President Biden has promised to choose a eminently qualified black woman. Now listen, I have no problem if a black woman is appointed to the Supreme Court. But it irks me to see a decision made in large part based on the color of someone's skin. And this irks me for a couple of reasons. One is the assumption that the best person wasn't chosen. It was the best black woman that was chosen. Now again, if a black woman is the most qualified and available, I got no problem with that. But we've become a nation where so many of the leadership focus so much on people's race. We truly are a racist nation. Because now you have a president that says, I'm not going to pick the best Asian woman, the best Hispanic person, the best Native American. Nope. This time around, we've pulled social justice, we spun the social justice wheel, and it has come up black woman. And what have we lost? Who may have been placed in that, nominated for that seat that didn't get a chance because of the color of their skin or the sex of their body? Why not pick the most constitutionally sound? We could use a lot of constitutional soundness on the Supreme Court. I am mortified at the constitutional illiteracy of the opinions that come out of the court. I'd love to have somebody who was constitutionally sound and strong enough to stand up to their oath to support the Constitution of the United States. But you see, this is being driven by identity politics. Not simply politics, identity politics. And that truly is sad. Now, President Biden isn't the first president to nominate someone based on an identity politics factor. Thurgood Marshall was the first black chief justice. Sandra Day O'Connor was the first woman placed on the court. There are a lot of firsts. But are we really putting race and sex before everything else? I know that's not the way the president put it, but placing such weight on a person's physical appearance rather than the content of the character, on the color of their skin rather than the content of their character, really shows that we have not fulfilled Dr. Martin Luther King's dream. We've actually fallen away from Dr. Martin Luther King's dream. But again, the president is authorized. He can nominate pretty much anybody he wants. There's no limitation placed on here. The assumption being the person will be qualified. So that in place, the president nominates. Then it goes on and says, and by and with the advice and consent of the Senate shall appoint ambassadors, public ministers, counsels, and judges of the Supreme Court. Now, there is a constitutional scholar out there, a lady by the name of Chris Ann Hall. I listen to her work. I think a lot of most of the things that she does. There's one area where she and I vehemently disagree. See, I've heard her say this multiple times, including in relation to the upcoming appointment of a new Supreme Court justice, that it's the Senate that appoints. But that's not entirely true either. Because it says, by and with the advice and consent of the Senate. See, the president says, he shall nominate and by and with the advice and consent of the Senate shall appoint, among other things, judges of the Supreme Court. So it's still the president appointing, but he's doing it by and with the advice and consent of the Senate. Now, why is this important? See, we've driven this down to the president appoints, the Senate consents. That's not the way it's supposed to work. There's that advice standpoint. And where this really came to fore recently was with the nomination of Merrick Garland at the end of Obama's second term. See, the Senate, at that point controlled the majority of which were Republicans, advised the president that they were not prepared to consent to a Supreme Court appointment with a presidential election in the future, in the near future. I said, no, it's too close. Let's give the people a chance to decide who the president's going to be and let the new president choose. That was their advice. And people went crazy. They were accused of of being negligent in their constitutional duties. There was all sorts of, it said, nope, but what does it say? That the president nominates by and with the advice and consent of the Senate. Doesn't say the president does it alone. Doesn't say the Senate is required to take up his nomination. Doesn't say anything like that. It's supposed to be by and with the advice and consent of the Senate. Now, this is for, I believe, two primary purposes. The first being to make sure that you've got a qualified individual. Our framers knew that politics would enter the discussion. It had to happen. So rather than having a single individual appoint these positions, including Supreme Court justice, they needed not simply the consent of the Senate, but the advice of the Senate. Yet when was the last time you, again, maybe it happens behind closed doors, but we certainly don't hear about presidents going to the Senate for advice when it comes to nominating and appointing justices. And I believe that is the second reason why the president doesn't do this alone. See, remember, the president effectively works for the states. I know, heresy. We've all been taught that the president works for the people. He does not. Look at the process of electing a president. The people don't vote for president. You did not vote for president. I can prove it. If you look at your ballot, if you can find online your ballot, you'll see that you voted for electors for president. We got a couple years before we're talking about a presidential election, but I'm sure the discussion will come up and we'll talk more details about that when it does. But the president is actually voted on by the states. Article 2, Section 1, Clause 2. Each state shall appoint in manner such as the legislature thereof may direct a number of electors equal to the whole number of senators and representatives to which the state may be entitled in the Congress. The states vote. It's a weighted vote based on their representation in Congress. So the president works for the states. And nominally, the Senate represents the states. See, originally, senators were not elected by the people. They were appointed by the state legislature. It's part of the reason why we have this bicameral legislature. The House was to represent the people. The Senate was to represent the states. The House was elected by the people. The Senate was elected by the states. That changed with the 17th Amendment, which I believe helped destroy the Republic. So you have the president working with the states, the representatives of the states, to come to the final decision about the appointment of these offices. So there are two reasons why this happens, and it's why it involves advice and consent. Now, there are members of the Senate that believe the president deserves to have every nomination approved unless there's something seriously wrong with the nominee. But that's not what the Constitution says. It says advice and consent. See, if you actually sit down and read the Constitution, you'll find there really isn't very much the president can do all on his own. What are the powers of the president? The president's there to execute the laws. Laws created by Congress, because the laws of the United States mostly come from Congress. The president's the commander-in-chief, but it's Congress that sets the rules to the military, not the president. The president does not call up the militia. He doesn't have the legal power to call up the militia. He does not. His role is not to negotiate foreign affairs. He's not delegated that power. He's a representative of the states, which is why so many of the actions he takes, such as negotiating treaties, appointing ministers, the president does with the advice and consent of the Senate, the representatives of the states. You see, the appointment of a Supreme Court justice should not be focused on the office of president. This is all the states should be involved. Because the president nominates, but it's the representatives of the states that advise and consent with the president on the appointment. So once President Biden places a name in a nomination, we go through the kabuki theater of confirmation. And it is truly kabuki theater. Generally, the pattern follows one of two patterns based on the political party of the president. Now, Joe Biden is a Democrat. He's a member of the Democratic Party. So mostly it will be a question of the Republican senators asking questions about Second Amendment rights, about the role of the Constitution in making decisions, while the candidate, the nominee, basically shucks and jives and tries to not trip over themselves and make themselves look stupid. Now, when a Republican is president, the question usually revolves around Roe v. Wade and stare decisis. You know, does the opinion of the court supersede the Constitution or not? And I'm sure there'll be some of that as well. There'll be some questions about stare decisis. But it all is going to come around to the Democrats are going to mostly laud the nomination. The Republicans will try to poke holes in it. But ultimately, it's going to come down to a political party vote. Plus or minus a couple of senators, that's usually the way things happen nowadays. The days of the 80 and 90 vote for a judicial nominee are pretty much gone. The spirit of revenge, natural to party dissension that George Washington warned about is in full flower. So, yeah, it's pretty much going to come down to a party line vote, which puts us in an interesting situation. You see, the Senate is split 50-50. Now, I said before, there are certain senators who believe that the president deserves a confirmation on their nominations unless they are truly unqualified. So I fully expect that two or three Republicans are going to vote for the nominee, and we will have a new Supreme Court justice. That's what I expect. I find it interesting that you rarely find those in the Democratic Party who show such deference to the position of president, but I can think of at least two or three senators on the Republican side that will probably side with the president and give him the nomination, the confirmation of the nomination that he wants. But there has been some very interesting discussions. I've heard more than one person talk about the filibuster rule. See, the filibuster rule has been waived for Supreme Court nominees. So in general, you need 51 votes to win, to approve, to confirm a nominee. But I've heard several people talking about, well, you know, it's 50-50, it'll be a tie. Well, yeah, in which case, Kamala Harris as the vice president is going to vote for whoever Joe Biden has nominated. And I've heard some people erroneously say that the vice president can only vote on legislation. They can't vote on things like nominations. Well, does that hold up to constitutional muster? Well, to find out, we go to Article 1, Section 3, Clause 4, which says the vice president of the United States shall be president of the Senate, but shall have no vote unless they be equally divided. Period. End of story. It doesn't put any limitations. Whenever the Senate is equally divided, the vice president casts the deciding vote. So even if we play the normal party politics and both sides hold serve, then you have a 50-50 tie, the vice president casts a tie-breaking vote, and Biden's nomination gets in. It's almost assuredly going to happen. I don't even think it'll require the vice president's vote, but almost assuredly we have this. The vice president's nominee will be confirmed and appointed to the Supreme Court. But there's one more step that happens, and it's a step that most people don't think about. See, in Article 2, Section 3, the president is given the power to say, to quote, shall commission all officers of the United States. You see, there's a process to the commissioning of an officer. The vote in the Senate doesn't make someone a Supreme Court justice. They must be commissioned into that office. They must take their oath of office and be commissioned. And that is the responsibility of the president. Now, frequently he delegates it to somebody else, but for a Supreme Court justice, you can expect the President of the United States to actually formally commission them into the office of president. There's a saying I've heard, the job's not done till the paperwork is done. And there's paperwork involved in doing this. And that is the role of the executive branch, which is the responsibility of the president. That's what I expect to happen. This is, now Justice Breyer has been a not constitutionally sound justice. I don't expect his replacement to be any more constitutionally sound than he was. Will they be better or worse than he was? We will have to wait and see. We never really know until the justice is on the court for a little while and we get a sense of how they come to their opinions. But I don't expect a tremendous shakeup in the structure of the court. I don't expect a change in how the court votes as a whole. Sure, we may have a few more 6-3s rather than 5-4s on certain cases because of the new justice, but it's not like I'm expecting to get a true constitutionally sound justice. I expect somebody on the par of Kagan or Sotomayor or even another Breyer, someone who has an end they want or appears to have an end they want and tries to manipulate the Constitution and laws to get to that end. Who puts their emotions above the actual law and who puts the desired outcome ahead of the oath they took to support the Constitution of the United States. That's what I expect. I don't, you know, that's why, you know, some people are making a big deal out of this. I don't think it's going to be a huge deal. I think it's going to be a lot of noise, but in the long run, not a lot of change, not a lot of real controversy, not unless President Biden nominates somebody that is so far beyond the pale, so far Marxist, socialist, damn the Constitution, we got to do what we got to do, that even members of the Democratic Party of the Senate cannot support them. Unless he nominates a Kamala Harris. There's been talk about nominating Kamala Harris. You know, it's interesting. They say, well, she's been the Attorney General of the state of California. Do you realize there is no qualification requirement for the office of Supreme Court Justice? You don't have to have a law degree. You don't have to have been a lawyer or a judge. In fact, I really wish they would nominate and appoint some people that actually could read the Constitution. But that's my own little dream. But if he were to nominate a Kamala Harris, by the way, I don't expect him to do it, someone who has been so vilified, who's been shown themselves to be so unqualified, so destructive of any concept of the rule of law and the Constitution, I fully expect this to go through and probably somewhere by the time Justice Breyer steps down in October, the nomination will either have been confirmed or be so close to being confirmed that it will be done before the midterm election, certainly before the new Congress is seated in January. I fully expect this is going to go through before that. And I really think the only thing that will be left will be, will they hold the confirmation vote before Justice Breyer steps down? Will they wait till he steps down? Will they hold it before he steps down and then postpone the appointment until he's... I don't know. We have to wait and see. But that's the part about understanding the Constitution, what it actually says. When people come up with these bizarre ideas like, you know, the vice president can't vote in a tie in the Senate if it involves a nomination doesn't hold muster. I really do wish that members of the Senate took their role of advice much more seriously. But this has become such a political football, such a political theater, that I'm not really surprised that they don't. It's one of the reasons why I think we need to hire better senators to represent our states rather than to represent some political party. Now, I have to take a break, but before I do, do me a favor, head over to constitutionstudy.com. I've been talking about reading and studying the Constitution, knowing it better. Well, I'm still putting on the Constitution Study, an online study, and you can still try it absolutely free. You can join the live events absolutely free. Just go to constitutionstudy.com/study, find out more about the study, register for free, and you can join us live on Zoom as we go through the Bill of Rights. And you can find out how to join the rest of the study once we're finished with the Bill of Rights section. That's all there, constitutionstudy.com. You can find the recordings over at constitutionscholars.com. It's all there. This is important information. I want you to share it. I want you to have access to it. Also, please check out healthycell.com. You know, vitamins really haven't changed much since the 1930s. They haven't been upgraded, at least until Healthy Cell came along. They designed their vitamins to work at a cellular level to do things like boost your immune system or help you sleep better or just plain focus. I don't know about you, I need focus sometimes. You get to the end of a long day and you can use that extra bit of focus. Mine tends to want to get fuzzy. So I'm currently using the Focus and Recall. I like it. It works well. It helps you get that short-term focus back. And it's better than the energy drinks or energy shots. It's not full of caffeine and sugar. It is a vitamin supplement. Now, as an America Out Loud listener, you get 20% off your first order. All you have to do is go to healthycell.com, try any of their formulas. Again, today I'm focusing on Focus and Recall, pun intended. Put together your order at checkout, use the code OUTLOUD, and you'll get 20% off your first order. So do that. Try any one of their supplements. I like the gels because you can take them directly or just mix them in a smoothie or a drink. But don't forget to use the code OUTLOUD at checkout to get 20% off your first order.
You know, Healthy Cell is a terrific lineup of products. They have products that are pill-free, gel-pack vitamins. Looking for better sleep, focus, and energy? Check out Healthy Cell, the leading innovator in nutritional supplements for cell health. Healthy Cell has a product that helps REM sleep, helps you fall asleep, stay asleep, sleep deeply, and wake up refreshed with Healthy Cell's REM sleep supplement. The only sleep supplement that's designed to support all stages of sleep. And boy, is it needed now during all the stress of the COVID-19 pandemic. So go to healthycell.com and use the code OUTLOUD, all capital letters, OUTLOUD, for a 20% off your first order of any product from Healthy Cell. I use them every day. I believe in them, and you should too. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Trouble getting to sleep and staying asleep can be infuriating. Your mind races. You toss and turn, and the harder you try, the harder it is to drift off. And today's digital age makes it even harder. You're not alone with this struggle. Poor sleep affects over 70% of Americans. Even the Centers for Disease Control label insufficient sleep a public health epidemic. To take back your sleep, Healthy Cell has created REM Sleep, the only sleep supplement made to support all four stages of human sleep with calming herbs, amino acids, and sleep hormone support. Delivered in a patent-pending, pill-free, ultra-absorption microgel formula that tastes great. Fall asleep, stay asleep, sleep deeply, and wake up refreshed with Healthy Cell's REM Sleep. Go to healthycell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order. That's healthycell.com, HEALTHYCELL, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
Invincible American spirit drives the most audacious experiment in the history of self-government. America Out Loud celebrates the American spirit every minute of every day. AmericaOutloud.com. Liberty and justice for all.
Welcome back, everyday Americans. You've returned to the Constitution Study, where we read and study the Constitution. We teach a rising generation to be free. Today, we're talking Supreme Court. We talked in the first half about Justice Breyer's retirement, what it means, what process will legally be going through in the nomination and appointment of a new Supreme Court justice. And hopefully, we dispelled a few myths you may have heard about the role of the vice president or the process through which a Supreme Court justice is appointed. Now, why is this so important? Well, if you take a look around, how many of the big decisions are being made by the courts? How many times have we seen states' rights, individual rights, the process of government being decided not based on the Constitution, but based on the opinion of nine high priests in black robes? See, it's very important. It is much more important today than it was back in 1788, because today we tend not to follow the Constitution. In fact, I am dismayed at the number of Supreme Court opinions I review where the Constitution either is not quoted, it may be mentioned, but it's not quoted, or if it is, it is badly misquoted, badly taken out of context. So it's really important that we have justices, that we start appointing justices not based on their political affiliations or their servitude to precedent and stare decisis, but to the actual language of the Constitution. Now, for example, let me give you a great example. There's a recent case called the Trustees of New Life Church, New Life in Christ Church versus the City of Fredericksburg, Virginia. Now, in this case, the church had a claimed a tax-exempt status for a residence occupied by a couple called the Storms. They were youth ministers. And the City of Fredericksburg tried to deny their tax-exempt status. Now, this went through years of litigation. And even though the city accepts that the Storms' home was their only residence the church sought tax-exempt status for, they acknowledge that the home of a subordinate minister can qualify for tax-exempt status, and they agree that state law does not supply a definition for the term minister. Instead, whether a person qualifies as a minister varies according to different religious denominations. These are all stipulated by the city. However, the city sought to justify denying tax exemption. Why? Well, the city argued that the church is not entitled to it because it misunderstands who qualifies as a minister in its own faith. That's right. The City of Fredericksburg says, "We know you're a minister. We call you. You know that the church calls you a minister. We know that you do these duties, but we don't think you know what you're talking about." Now, this went all the way to this. Well, it tried to go all the way to the Supreme Court. They petitioned the court for what's called certiorari, or to be heard before the court, and that writ of certiorari was denied. Now, in a dissent to this decision not to hear this case, Justice Gorsuch, he went on an interesting tirade. He said, quote, "I would grant the petition summarily reverse. The First Amendment does not permit bureaucrats or judges to subject religious belief to verification. About this, the court has spoken plainly and consistently for many years." Okay, and he goes on to some of the other legal standards, the legal basis for that. Now, that all sounds great, right? You know, Justice Gorsuch is right. There's just there's a couple itchy bitchy little problems. Now, Justice Gorsuch is correct. The First Amendment does not permit bureaucrats or judges to subject religious beliefs to verification. That violates both the Establishment and Free Exercise Clauses. There's just one tiny little problem. You see, the First Amendment starts with Congress shall make no law. Congress didn't make this law. The city of Fredericksburg, Maryland was not acting, as far as I understand, based on a law from Congress. Therefore, this is not a First Amendment violation. So even a justice that appears to have a really good grasp of the Constitution keeps missing some very basic points. Now, this was a violation of the Virginia Constitution. It's also a violation of, I believe, the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause. I haven't read in detail about the case, but here you have a judge who says, listen, not only would I have allowed the petition, I would have summarily reversed, because the very idea of government bureaucrats subjecting religious beliefs to verification to require the government's permission to determine whether or not your religious belief is really religious belief is antithetical. And again, not just to the First Amendment, but to the freedom of religion clauses in each and every one of the constitutions of the 50 states. So it's interesting. I saw this article and it's like, yay, great. Justice Gorsuch, the Blaze put it as, torches Virginia city and church tax case dissent. And he really kind of did. He really let him have it. He just kind of missed a certain very important point. How can the city of Virginia, since it is not Congress, neither is it acting under a law created by Congress, violate the First Amendment? Now, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I don't. I haven't researched this case. Maybe they were acting on a law established by Congress. Maybe they were looking at the IRS code. But this was not a question of IRS tax exemption. This is a question of tax exemption from the city. And in fact, the what I have read of the of Justice Gorsuch's description of the city's position, as I said, the city admits, they stipulate that state law does not supply a definition for the term minister. Therefore, this is a question of state law. So, on the one hand, I'm happy that Justice Gorsuch at least gave a vigorous defense of freedom of religion. I only wish he had done it in the proper context as a violation of the Equal Protection Clause under the 14th Amendment, not the First Amendment. So I know it's these details that often make the difference. Now, the court does a lot of work. I've talked a lot about what the court does. I've got more court cases that I expect to be coming up. I'm waiting for the opinions to issue, and then I'll be talking about them. But we have another case the Supreme Court is going to hear dealing with challenges to both Harvard and University of North Carolina's affirmative action policies. These cases are going to the Supreme Court. And since this case is late enough in the season, it most likely will be heard by the new justice, not Justice Breyer. Now, what are these cases? It all has to do with the determination of race and a question of college admission. Now, the court has said it's going to take the case and possibly reconsider using race-based affirmative action in college admissions. Now, in the case against Harvard, the challengers say the same practices have for 40 years you've been used to help Black and Hispanic students, not necessarily applicants from disadvantaged backgrounds, but simply based on the color of their skin, help them to gain admission to an elite school, Harvard, while at the same time hurting Asian American applicants. The point being made, if you have two students, with similar but maybe not equal scores, Do you choose a student with the higher test scores, the most academically capable? Or do you give a leg up to what you consider to be a disadvantaged group? And again, you're not dealing with disadvantaged applicants. It could be a very wealthy, a very well-educated. They may not require assistance, but they're getting an extra hand up. And they're in order to do that, you have to harm somebody else. Now, these cases, they probably won't be heard until, again, the new session that starts in October, generally in October. So we've got a while to hear this one out. But it brings up an interesting question. Can race be used as a deciding factor in college admission? Is that not discrimination based on race? If you're giving an advantage to one racial group, are you not inherently disadvantaging another racial group? And again, these are dealing with, well, at least in the University of North Carolina, it's public schools. So there's a whole other question going on there. I'm sure that I will be covering this when it gets, when oral arguments are heard and when an opinion is released, probably not till June of 2023. But it's interesting to note that lower courts have previously sided both with Harvard and the University of North Carolina. That lower courts have said it is okay to discriminate if you think it's for a good cause, if you're making up for some evil that was done in the past. This will be decided by the court. And the new justice of the Supreme Court will hear this case and be part of the decision-making process that will ultimately impact not just Harvard and the University of North Carolina, but every college, every university, and every student that applies to them. Kind of a big set of purchases for 9 ladies and gentlemen in black robes. Now, if you want a good understanding of the original intent, of the design of the Judiciary Department, the place to start, in my opinion, is Federalist Paper number 78, written by Alexander Hamilton. Now, he discusses many things about the Judiciary Department, but I want to take a look at a few. Well, let's start with this paragraph. Whoever attentively considers different departments of power must perceive that in a government in which they are separated from each other, the judiciary, from the nature of its function, will always be the least dangerous to the political rights of the Constitution because it will be least in capacity to annoy or injure them. The executive not only dispenses the honors, but holds the sword of the community. The legislature not only commands the purse, but prescribes the rules by which the duties and rights of every citizen are to be regulated. The judiciary, on the contrary, has no influence over either the sword or the purse, no direction either of the strength or the wealth of the society, and can take no active resolution whatever. It may truly be said to have neither force nor will, but merely judgment, and must ultimately depend upon the aid of the executive arm, even for the efficacy of his judgments. Now, compare that to the way we treat courts today. See, Alexander Hamilton is saying, listen, the courts are the least capable of injuring your rights. They have neither force nor will, only judgment. They can't do anything. Yet how often have you heard an opinion of the court referred to as a ruling, as if these were kings and queens on benches, issuing edicts and rulings and governing the nation? How often have you heard of a law that was suspended until it got the approval of the judiciary? Until some court said it was okay? See, part of reading and understanding the Constitution, studying it, knowing what it says, is recognizing the slow changes over time that morphs a constitutional republic into a dictatorial oligarchy. You see, the courts have no power. All they're doing is offering an opinion. And that opinion, by the way, is only binding on the people in a case. I've heard it described frequently, right? The legislature writes the law, the executive executes the law, the courts apply the law. No. The purpose of a court is to decide controversies involving the law. All the law, by the way, not just the little bitty piece that maybe a lawyer brings. Their job is to look at the case and apply the law. It's where we get this concept of judicial review, going back to the case Marbury versus Madison. Yet the problem is we completely misconstrue what Chief Justice Marshall wrote in the opinion. You see, in the opinion he wrote, it is emphatically the province and duty of the Judicial Department to say what the law is. And this has been used for decades, for a century or more, to allow the courts to basically act as a super legislature, to reinterpret what the law says. But if you go back to the original opinion, which I did, and you read that phrase in context, well, it sounds a little different. Quote, it is emphatically the province and duty of the judicial department to say what the law is. Those who apply the rule to particular cases must, of necessity, expound and interpret that rule. If two laws conflict with each other, the courts must decide on the operation of each. So yes, the judicial department has to look at the law and say what it is because it's got to compare the law to the supreme law. And it must expound and interpret that law. And if there are two in conflict, well, the court must decide on their operation. In other words, the court isn't blessing law the way we treat judicial review today. It's not reinterpreting law, as is so often happened by the courts, to get an outcome they desire. It's an understanding of the law. It's to know what the law means, to be able to determine what it says and how it applies and compare it to other laws. The Chief Justice Marshall went on, if then the courts are to regard the Constitution and the Constitution is superior to any ordinary act of the legislature, the Constitution and not such ordinary act must govern the case to which they both apply. In other words, the court looks at it and says, here is a law. And here is the Constitution, which is a superior law. It's the supreme law of the land, Article 6, Clause 2. And it must look at it and say the Constitution must be superior to an ordinary act of the legislature. Therefore, the Constitution must govern when they are both to be applied. But compare that to how it's used today, where courts, again, reinterpret laws, reinterpret the Constitution. They replace words like unreasonable search with the word privacy, and then come up with a whole bunch of opinions based on that, and then elevate their opinions above the actual language of the Constitution. This is the problem with what is properly termed judicial supremacy, the placing of the opinion of a judge above the actual law, including the Constitution. But while Mr. Hambledon says courts have no force or will, they do have an important role to play. Back to Federalist 78. The complete independence of the courts of justice is peculiarly essential in a limited constitution. By a limited constitution, I understand one which contains a certain specified exemptions to the legislative authority, such, for instance, as that it shall pass no bill of attainder, no ex post facto laws, and the like. Limitations of this kind can be preserved in practice no other way than through the medium of courts of justice, whose duty it must be to declare all acts contrary to the manifest tenor of the Constitution void. Without this, all reservations of particular rights or privileges would amount to nothing. See, courts have an important role. So when we're choosing justices of the courts, it is important that we not focus on the political party of the person appointing them or nominating them. That we shouldn't be focusing on their race or their sex. The question is, will they act as an independent court? Will they fulfill the duty of declaring acts contrary to the tenor of the Constitution void? Will they protect your rights that are protected by the Constitution? If they do not, everything else is moot. How can you have rights protected when the courts refuse to place the Constitution above their preferences? And as I quote frequently from Federalist 78, there is no position which depends on clearer principles than that every act of a delegated authority contrary to the tenor of the commission under which it is exercised is void. Every governmental office is a delegated authority. Every governmental office holds a delegated authority. And when they act contrary to their commission, be that commission directly the Constitution or the law that created the office, which must be within the scope of the Constitution, within the powers delegated by the Constitution, any act contrary to that is void. And we depend on courts to uphold that standard, which is why a judge is not given, in my opinion, a judge is not given a term limit, a period of time to serve. They are to serve during their good behavior. But we've given up on holding them accountable for their bad behavior. We find judges that put their preferences above the language of the Constitution, that put their desired goals above the acts of Congress, that act more like legislators than justices, and they are never punished for it. And that is not only a recipe for disaster, it is the tyranny that we have today, where laws are unconstitutional laws are allowed to survive because they meet some political agenda that enough justices supported to prevent it from being overturned. While other laws, perfectly constitutional, are overturned by the courts because, well, they don't like the way it was done. Chief Justice Roberts, in his opinion about the census question under the Trump administration, said what he did was constitutional. We just don't like the way he did it. Effectively, that's what he said. See, my concern is not the race or gender of the justice. It's their fidelity to that oath to support the Constitution. Mr. Hamlin goes on in Federalist 78, nor does this conclusion by any means suppose a superiority of the judicial to the legislative power. It only supposes that the power of the people is superior to both, and that where the will of the legislature, declared in its statutes, stands in opposition to that of the people, declared in the Constitution, the judges ought to be governed by the latter rather than the former. They ought to regulate their decisions by the fundamental laws rather than those which are not fundamental. And isn't that the point? Yet look today. Look at the world today. Look at how we govern today. Which branch of government is superior? See, right now we act like the judicial branch is superior to the legislative. Congress passes a law. If the courts don't like it, they simply say, nope, we enjoin it. We won't let it go into effect. We go through all these machinations. Is that really the way our country is supposed to run? No. The judiciary is not supposed to be superior to the legislative, but both of them are supposed to be subservient to the people and our declared will in the Constitution. And whether that be a member of the legislature or the member of the judiciary, when they act contrary to the will of the people declared in the Constitution, they are acting badly, and we need to hold them accountable for it. Now, Alexander Hamlin closes Federalist 78 with, upon the whole, there can be no room to doubt that the convention acted wisely in copying the models of those constitutions which have established good behavior as a tenure for their judicial offices in point of duration, and that so far from being blamable on this account, their plan would have been inexcusably defective if it had wanted this important feature of good government. It's important to understand the reason why federal judges serve during their good behavior. It is just as important that they be held accountable for that behavior. So as we prepare for another round of Supreme Court judicial hearings and accusations and name-calling and general mess, let us consider these things. Let us ask ourselves, whoever is nominated, regardless of their skin color, regardless of their gender, regardless of where they went to school, let us ask a question. Do they have a history of good judicial behavior? Have they, as Alexander Hamilton said, showed that inflexible and uniform adherence to the rights of the Constitution and of individuals which we perceive to be indispensable in the courts of justice? Have they demonstrated that? And if they have, then why do we care about anything else? Why do we care about political party? Why do we care about gender? Why do we care about race? The reason we care about these things is because the appointment of judges ceased to be the appointment of good judges and has become a political tool. A tool for those who have used the courts to get their way when they couldn't get their way via the legislature. A tool for those who got their way in contravention to the Constitution, and a tool for those who put party above their country and above their oath to the Constitution. Hopefully, we would have learned from the recent past that these are the standards. Sadly, I doubt that will take place with this nomination. Because the American people have yet to punish their senators for politicizing their advice and their consent when it comes to the appointment of federal judges, whether they be on the Supreme Court or an inferior court. Now, all of my shows go to podcast typically a day or two after the broadcast is heard on the radio. You can hear them on Spotify, Stitcher, Pandora, and iHeart Podcasts, basically anywhere you get your podcasts. Do me a favor, be sure to subscribe and even give me a rating on Apple Podcasts. It helps others find the Constitution Study, and it helps us share the blessings of liberty.
Hey, Bill, stay out of jail.